They didn't deserve that. And Eric had put them there. It was his responsibility. The barred door at the top of the stairs stood open. Eric went through and used his big flash in the near darkness. The cell doors stood open. All but one. All but one. Eric went to the cell. Fred Lawrence stood with his back to the corridor. His left arm was cradled in his right. Lawrence stared out the window, and he didn't turn when Eric flashed the light on him. Eric stood watching him for a moment. No one deserved to drown like a rat in a cage. No human did. The thieves and drunks and runaways and... "Turn around," Eric said. Lauren didn't move. "Turn around or I'll shoot your kneecaps out. That hurts a lot." Fred whimpered and turned. He saw the shotgun leveled at him. The policeman was holding the light off to one side, almost behind himself, so that Fred could see. "Do you know who I am?" the policeman asked.
"Yes. You kept the other policeman from beating me last night."
Fred moved closer. He stared at the shotgun.
"Is that for me?"
"I brought it for you," Eric said. "I came to turn the others loose. I couldn't let you loose, so I brought the shotgun."
"It's the end of the world," Fred Lauren said. "All of it. Nothing will be left, but..."
Fred whimpered deep in his throat.
"But when? Would... Please, you've got to tell me. Wouldn't she be dead now, already? She couldn't live through the end of the world. She'd have died, and I'd never have talked to her."
"Talk to her?" Eric brought the shotgun up in rage. He saw Fred Lauren standing calmly, waiting, and he saw the bed and the ruins of a young girl, and the closet with the pathetically small wardrobe. There was a smell of copper blood in his nostrils. His fingers tightened on the trigger, then relaxed. He lowered the shotgun.
"Please," Fred Lauren said. "Please."
The shotgun came up quickly. Eric hadn't known it would kick so hard. Hot Fudge Tuesday, 2. Oh, I run to the hills, and the hills were a-fallin'. Run to the sea, and the sea was a-boilin'. Run to the sky, and the sky was a-burnin'. All on that day. Static roared in the crowded room. Random blobs and colors filled the large TV, but 20 men and women stared at the screen where they had watched lights blaze and die above the Atlantic, above Europe, Northwest Africa, the Gulf of Mexico. Only Dan Forrester continued to work. The screen above his console held a computer-drawn world map, and Forrester laboriously called up all the data received at JPL, plotting the strikes and using their locations as input for more calculations. Charles Sharps felt that he ought to be interested in Forrester's calculations, but he wasn't. Instead, he watched the others. Open mouths, bulging eyes, feet thrusting them back into their chairs. They cringed back from their blinded consoles and screens, as if these were the danger. And still Forrester typed instructions, made precise movements, studied results, and typed again. "Hammerfall," Sharps said to himself. "And what the hell do we do about it?" He couldn't think of anything, and the room depressed him. He left his station and went to the long table against one wall. There were coffee and Danish there, and Sharps poured himself a cup. He stared into it, then lifted it in a mock salute. "Doom," he said. He kept his voice low. The others began to rise from their stations. "Doom," Sharps repeated. "Ragnarok. And what use now was man's proud civilization? Ice Age, Fire Age, Axe Age, Wolf Age." He turned to see that Forrester had left his station and was moving toward the door.
"What now?" Sharps asked.
"Earthquake."
Forrester continued to walk rapidly toward the exit.
"Earthquake,"
he said it loudly so that everyone could hear, and there was a rush toward the door. Dr. Charles Sharps poured his cup almost full. He took it to the tap and ran a splash of cold water into it. It was Mocha Java, made less than an hour ago with a Melita filter and kept in a clean thermos.
a pity to water it, but now it was just cool enough to drink. How long would it be before ships crossed major oceans again? Years? Decades? Forever? He might never taste coffee again. Sharps drained the cup in four swallows and dropped it onto the floor. The heavy china bounced and rolled against a console. Sharps went outside at a run. The others had passed Forrester in the hall. The glass doors at the entrance were just closing behind him. That urgent waddle. Dan Forrester had never been athletic, but surely he could move faster than that. Did they have time to spare, then? Sharps jogged to catch up. "Parking lot," Dan puffed. "Watch it." Sharps stumbled, recovered. Dan was dancing on one leg. The ground had jerked emphatically, once. Sharps thought, "Why, that wasn't bad. The buildings aren't even harmed." "Now," Forrester said. He continued toward the parking lot. It was at the top of a long flight of concrete stairs. Dan stopped near the top, blowing hard, and Sharps got a shoulder under his armpit and managed to half-carry him the rest of the way to the top. There Dan lay down and rolled over. Sharps watched him with concern. Forrester puffed, tried to say something, and failed. He was too winded. He lifted one arm and gestured with palm down. "Sit." Too late. The ground danced under his feet, and Sharps sat down too hard, then found himself rolling toward the stairs. This time there was the sound of breaking glass, but when Sharps looked over the JPL complex, he didn't see any obvious damage. Down below, the reporters were beginning to stream out of the Von Karman Center, but many paused after the mild quake, and some went back inside. "Tell them," puff, puff, "tell them to get out," Forrester said. "The worst one is coming." Charles Sharps called to the reporters. "Big shock coming. Get everyone outside." He recognized the New York Times man. "Get them out," Sharps called. He turned to see that Forrester was on his feet and moving rapidly toward the back of the parking lot, away from the cars. He was walking as fast as Sharps had ever seen him move. "Hurry," Sharps called to the others. Men and women were spilling out of all the JPL buildings. Some came toward Sharps and the parking lot. Others milled about in areas between buildings, wondering where to go. Sharps gestured viciously, then looked at Forrester. Dan had reached a clear area and was sitting down. Sharps turned and ran toward Forrester. He reached him and sprawled onto the asphalt. Nothing happened for a moment.
"First shock was the ground wave from the Death Valley strike," Forrester huffed. "Then the Pacific strike. Don't know how long until it triggers."
The earth groaned. Birds flew into the air, and there was an electric feeling of impending doom. Down at the end of the parking lot, a group had just come to the top of the stairs and were moving toward Forrester and Sharps. The earth groaned again. Then it roared.
"San Andreas," Forrester said. "It will let go completely. Way overdue. 100 megatons of energy. Maybe more."
Half a dozen people had cleared the stairwell. Two came toward Sharps and Forrester. The rest sought their own cars.
"Get them out of there," Forrester huffed.
"Get into the clear," Sharps screamed, "and clear off that stairwell. Get off."
A TV camera appeared at the top of the stairs. A man was carrying it, followed by a woman. There was a knot of people behind them. The TV crew started across the parking lot, and the earth moved. There was time for them to curl up, hugging their knees in the 2 or 3 seconds it took the quake to build strength. The earth roared again and again, and there were other sounds of people screaming, of falling glass and crashing concrete, and then the sound lost all form and became the shapeless chaos of nightmare. Sharps tried to sit erect and look back toward JPL, but nothing was solid. The asphalt rippled and ripped. The hot pavement slid gratingly away, throwing Sharps into a double somersault, then heaved and bucked once more, and the world was filled with sound and roaring and screams. Finally, it was over. Sharps sat and tried to focus his eyes. The world had changed. He looked up toward the towering Angelus Mountains, and their skyline was different, subtly, but different. He had no time to see more. There was sound behind him, and he turned to see that part of the parking lot was gone, the rest tilted at strange angles. Many of the cars were gone, tumbled over the precipice that had developed between him and the stairs. Only there weren't any stairs. They, too, had tumbled onto the lower parking lot. The remaining cars butted each other like battling beasts. Everywhere was sound. Cars, buildings, rocks, all grinding together. A Volkswagen rolled ponderously toward Sharps, like a steel tumbleweed growing huge. Sharps screamed and tried to run. His legs wouldn't hold him. He fell, crawled, and saw the VW tumble past his heels, a mountain of painted metal. It smashed itself half flat against a Lincoln, and now it was only Volkswagen-sized again. Another small car was on its back, and someone was under it, thrashing. Oh, God, it was Charlene, and there wasn't a hope of anyone getting to her. Abruptly, she stopped moving. The ground continued to tremble and groan, then thrashed. More of the parking lot separated, dipped, slid slowly downhill, carrying Charlene and her killer car. Now Sharps no longer heard the roar. He was deaf. He lay flat on the shuddering ground, waiting for it to end. The tower, the large central building of JPL, was gone. In its place, there was a crumpled mass of glass, concrete, twisted metal, broken computers. The Von Karman Center was similarly in ruins. One wall had fallen, and through it Sharps saw the first unmanned lunar lander, the metal spider that had gone to the moon to scoop up its surface. The spacecraft was helpless under the falling roof. Then the walls collapsed as well, burying the spacecraft and burying the science press corps.
"End! When will it end?"
someone was screaming. Sharps could barely hear the words. Finally, the quake began to die. Sharps stayed down. He would not tempt the fates. What remained of the parking lot was tilted downslope and bulged in the middle. Now Sharps had time to wonder who had been on the stairway behind the cameramen. Not that it mattered. They were gone. The camera people were gone. Everyone who had been within 50 feet of the stairwell had vanished into the mass below, covered by the hillside and the mangled remains of cars. The day was darkening, visibly darkening. Sharps looked up to see why. A black curtain was rolling across the sky. Within churning black clouds, the lightning flared as dozens, scores, hundreds of flashbulbs. Lightning flared and split a tree to their right. The instantaneous thunder was deafening, and the air smelled of ozone. More lightning crashed in the hills ahead.
"Do you know where you're going?" Tim Hamner demanded.
"No," Eileen drove on, speeding through empty, rain-washed streets.
"There's a road up into the hills here somewhere. I've been up it a couple of times."
To their left and behind them were more houses, mostly intact. To the right were the Verdugo Hills, with small side streets penetrating a couple of blocks into them, each street with its dead-end sign. Except for the rain and lightning, everything seemed normal here. The rain hid everything not close to them, and the houses, mostly older, stucco Spanish style, stood without visible damage.
"Aha!"
Eileen cried. She turned hard right onto a blacktop road that twisted its way along the base of a high bluff, a protruding spur of the lightning-washed mountains ahead. The road twisted ahead, and soon they saw nothing but the hill to the right, the brooding mountains looming above, and a golf course to their left. There were neither cars nor people. They turned, turned again, and Eileen jammed on the brakes. The car skidded to a halt. It stood face to face with a landslide. 10 feet and more of flint and mud blocked their way. "Walk," Tim said. He looked out at the lightning ahead and shuddered.
"The road goes a lot further," Eileen said. "Over the top of the hills, I think."
She pointed to her left, at the golf course protected by its chain-link fence.
Tear a hole in the fence.
With what? Tim demanded, but he got out. Rain soaked him almost instantly. He stood helplessly. Eileen got out on the other side and brought the trunk keys. There was a jack, and a few flares, and an old raincoat, oil-soaked as if it had been used to wipe the engine. Eileen took out the jack handle.
Is that... Tim, we don't have much time.
I know. Hamner took the thin metal rod and went over to the fence. He stood helplessly, pounding the jack handle into his right hand. The task looked hopeless. He heard the trunk lid slam, then the car door. The starter whirred. Tim looked around, startled, but the car wasn't moving. He couldn't see Eileen's face through the driving rain and wet glass. Would she leave him here? Experimentally, he put the jack handle between the wire and a fence post and twisted. Nothing happened. He strained, throwing his weight onto the handle, and something gave. He slipped and fell against the fence and felt his wet clothing tear as a jagged point snagged him. It cut him, and the salt on his clothes was in the wound. He hunched his shoulders against the pain and hopelessness and stood, helpless again.
"Tim, how are you doing?"
He wanted to turn and call to her. He wanted to tell her it was no use, and that he was miserable, and he'd torn his clothes, and... Instead, he crouched and inserted the jack handle again, twisting and prying at the wire until it broke free of the post. Then again, and again, and suddenly the whole length of fence was loose there. He went to the next post and began his work. Eileen gunned the car. The horn sounded, and she called, "Stand aside!" The car left the road and came at the fence, rammed it, tore it loose from another post, and flattened it onto the grass, and the car drove over it. The car motor raced.
"Get in!" she called.
Tim ran for it. She hadn't stopped completely, and now it seemed she wasn't going to stop at all. He ran to catch up and tugged open the door, threw himself onto the seat. She gunned the car across the fairway, leaving deep ruts, then came to a green. She drove across it. The car tore at the carefully manicured surface. Tim laughed. There was a note of hysteria in it.
"What?"
Eileen asked. She didn't take her eyes off the grassy fairway ahead.
"I remember when some lady stepped on the Los Angeles Country Club green with spiked heels," Tim said. "The steward nearly died. I thought I understood Hammerfall and what it meant, but I didn't, not until you drove across the greens."
She didn't say anything, and Tim stared moodily ahead again. How many man-hours had gone to produce that perfect grassy surface? Would anyone ever again bother? Tim had another wild impulse to laughter. If there were golf clubs in the car, he could get out and tee off on a green. Eileen went completely across the golf course and back to the blacktop road up into the hills. Now they were in wilderness, high hills on either side of them. They passed a picnic ground. There were Boy Scouts there. They had a tent set up, and they seemed to be arguing with the scoutmaster. Tim opened the car window.
"Stay on high ground," he shouted.
"What's happened below?" the scoutmaster asked.
Eileen slowed to a stop.
"Fires. Floods. Traffic jams," Tim said. "Nothing you'll want to go into. Not for a while."
He motioned the adult closer.
"Stay up here, at least for the night."
"Our families," the man said.
"Where?"
"Studio City."
"You can't go there now," Tim said. "Traffic's not moving in the valley. Roads closed, freeways down, lot of fires. The best thing you can do for your families is to stay up here where you're safe."
The man nodded. He had big brown eyes in a square, honest face. There was a stubble of red beard on his chin.
"I've been telling the kids that. Julianne, you hear that? Your mother knows where we are. If things were really bad down there, they'd send the cops after us. Best we stay here."
He lowered his voice.
"Lot of rebuilding to do after that quake, I guess. Many hurt."
"Yeah,"
Tim said. He turned away. He couldn't look into the scoutmaster's eyes.
"We'll stay another day, then," the scoutmaster said. "They ought to have things moving again by tomorrow. Kids aren't really prepared for this rain, though. Nobody expects rain in June. Maybe we ought to go down into Burbank and stay in a house or a church. They'd put us up.
Don't, Tim said. His voice was urgent.
Not yet. Does this road go on over the top?
Yes.
The man brought his face close to Tim's.
Why do you want to go up into that?
He waved toward the lightning that flashed on the peaks above.
Why?
Have to, Tim said. You stay here, for the night anyway. Let's go, Eileen.
They drove off without saying anything. They rounded a bend, leaving the scoutmaster standing in the road.
I couldn't tell him either,
Eileen said.
Are they safe there?
I think so. We seem to be pretty high.
The top is about 3,000 feet, Eileen said.
And we're no more than 1,000 below it. We're safe,
Tim said.
Maybe it would be better to wait here until the lightning stops, if it ever does stop. Then we can go on or go back. Where do we get if we go over?
Tuhunga, Eileen said. It's a good 1,800, 2,000 feet elevation. If we're safe, Tuhunga should be.
She continued to drive, winding further into the hills. Tim frowned. He had never had a good sense of direction, and there were no maps in the car.
My observatory is up Big Tuhunga Canyon. At least you can get to it by going up that road. I've done it, and the observatory has food and emergency equipment and supplies.
Hammer fever, Eileen teased. You?
No, it's remote up there. I've been snowbound more than once, a week at a time, more, so I keep plenty of supplies.
Where are we going? Why don't you stop?
I don't know.
She drove on, more slowly, almost crawling along. The rain had slackened off. It was still pouring down, hard for Los Angeles, unheard of for summer. But just then it was only rain, not bathtubs of water pouring out of the sky. In compensation, the wind rose, howling up the canyon, screaming at them so that they were shouting at each other. But the wind was such a constant companion that by now they didn't notice. They came around another bend, and they were on a high shelf looking south and westward. Eileen stopped the car, despite the danger of slides from above them. She turned off the motor. The wind howled, and lightning played above and ahead. The rain beat down, so that the San Fernando Valley was obscured. But sometimes the wind whipped the rain in a thinner pattern, and they could see blurred shapes out there. There were bright orange flares down on the valley floor, dozens of them.
What are those? Eileen wondered aloud. Houses, filling stations, power plant oil storage, cars, homes, overturned tank trucks, anything that can burn.
Rain and fire.
She shivered, despite the warmth inside the car. The wind howled again. Tim reached for her. She held back a moment, then came to him, her head against his chest. They sat that way, listening to the wind, watching orange flames blur through driving rain.
We'll make it, Tim said. The observatory. We'll get there. We may have to walk, but it's not that far. 20, 30 miles, no more. Couple of days if we walk. Then we'll be safe.
No, she said. No one will ever be safe. Not again.
Sure we will.
He was silent for a moment.
I'm really glad you found me, he said. I'm not much of a hero, but...
You're doing fine.
They were quiet again. The wind continued to whistle, but gradually they became aware of another sound. Low, rumbling, building in volume like a jet plane. 10 jets, 1,000 jets roaring for takeoff. It came from the south, and as they watched, some of the orange flares ahead of them went out. They didn't flicker and die. They went out suddenly, snuffed from view in an instant. The noise grew, rushing closer.
Tsunami,
Tim said. His voice was low, wondering.
It really did come. A tidal wave. Hundreds, maybe thousands of feet high.
Thousands?
Eileen said nervously.
We'll be all right. The waves can't move far across land. It takes a lot of energy to move across land. A lot.
Listen,
it's coming up the old Los Angeles riverbed, not across the Hollywood Hills.
Anyone up there is probably safe. God help the people in the valley. As they sat, holding each other, while lightning played around and above them, and they heard the rolling thunder of lightning, and above the thunder, the roar of the tsunami, as one by one the bright orange fires went out in the San Fernando Valley. Between Baja California and the west coast of Mexico is a narrow body of water whose shoreline is like the two prongs of a tuning fork. The Sea of Cortez is as warm as bathwater and as calm as a lake, a playground for swimmers and sailors. But now the pieces of Hamner Brown's nucleus sink through Earth's atmosphere like tiny blue-white stars. One drops toward the mouth of the Sea of Cortez until it touches water between the prongs. Then water explodes away from a raw orange-white crater. The tsunami moves south in an expanding crescent, but confined between two shorelines, the wave moves north like the wave front down a shotgun barrel. Some water spills east into Mexico, some west across Baja to the Pacific. Most of the water leaves the northern end of the Sea of Cortez as a moving, white-peaked mountain range. The Imperial Valley, California's second-largest agricultural region, might as well have been located in the mouth of a shotgun. The survivors crawled toward each other across the broken JPL parking lot. A dozen men, five women, all dazed, crawling together. There were more people below in the wreckage of the buildings. They were screaming. Other survivors went to them. Sharps stood dazed. He wanted to go below and help, but his legs wouldn't respond. The sky was boiling with clouds. They raced in strange patterns, and if there was daylight coming through the swirling ink, it was much dimmer than the continual flash of lightning everywhere. Wonderingly, Sharps heard children crying, then a voice calling his name. "Dr. Sharps, help!" It was Al Masterson, the janitor in Sharps's building. He had gathered two other survivors. They stood beside a station wagon that rested against a big green Lincoln. The station wagon was tilted at a 45-degree angle, two wheels on the blacktop, two above it. The crying children were inside it. "Hurry, please, sir," Masterson called. That broke the spell. Charlie Sharps ran across the parking lot to help. He and Masterson and two other men strained at the heavily loaded station wagon until it tilted back to vertical. Masterson threw open the door. There were two young faces, tear-stained, and an older one, June Masterson. She wasn't crying. "They're all right," she was saying. "I told you they were all right." The station wagon was packed to the roof and beyond. Food, water, cans of gas lashed to its tailgate, clothing, shotgun, and ammunition, the stuff of survival, with the children and their blankets fitted in somehow. Masterson was telling everyone who would listen, "I heard you say it. The hammer might hit us. I heard." A corner of Sharps's mind giggled quietly to itself. Masterson the janitor. He'd heard just enough from the engineers, and of course he hadn't understood the odds against, so he'd been ready, geared to survive, with his family waiting in the parking lot just in case. The rest of us knew too much. Family. "What do we do, Dr. Sharps?" Masterson asked. "I don't know." Sharps turned to Forrester. The pudgy astrophysicist hadn't been able to help right the car. He seemed to be lost in thought, and Sharps turned away again. "I guess we do what we can for survivors, only I've got to get home."
"Me too."
There was a chorus of voices. "But we should stay together," Sharps said. "There won't be many people you can trust."
"Caravan," Masterson said. "We take some cars, and we all go get our families. Where do you all live?"
It turned out there was too much variety. Sharps lived nearby, in La Cañada. So did two others. The rest had homes scattered as far as Burbank and Canoga Park in the San Fernando Valley. The valley people had haunted eyes.
"I wouldn't," Forrester said. "Wait, a couple of hours..."
They nodded. They all knew.
400 miles an hour,
Hal Crane said.
A few minutes ago, he'd been a geologist. More, Forrester said. The tsunami will arrive about 50 minutes after Hammerfall. He glanced at his watch. Less than half an hour.
We can't just stand here,
Crane shouted. He was screaming. They all were. They couldn't hear their own voices. Then the rain came. Rain. Mud. Sharps was startled to see pellets of mud splatter onto the blacktop. Pellets of mud, hard and dry on the outside, with soft centers. They hit the cars with loud clatters. A hail of mud. The survivors scrambled for shelter. Inside cars, under cars, in the wrecks of cars.
Mud! Sharps screamed.
Yes, should have thought of it, Forrester said. Salt mud, from the sea bottom, thrown up into space and...
The strange hail eased, and they left their shelters. Sharps felt better now.
All of you who live too far to get to your homes, go down and help the survivors in the building area. The rest of us will go get our families. In caravan. We'll come back here if we can. Dan, what's our best final destination?
Forrester looked unhappy.
North. Not low ground. The rain could last for months. All the old river valleys may be filled with water. There's no place in the Los Angeles basin that's safe, and there will be aftershocks from the earthquake.
So where?
Sharps demanded.
The Mojave, eventually,
Forrester said. He wouldn't be hurried.
But not at first, because there's nothing growing there now. Eventually...
Yes, but now, Sharps demanded.
Foothills of the Sierras,
Forrester said.
Above the San Joaquin Valley.
Porterville area?
Sharps asked.
I don't know where that is.
Masterson reached into his station wagon and fished in the glove compartment. The rain was falling heavily now, and he kept the map inside the car. They stood outside, looking in at June Masterson and her children. The children were quiet. They watched the adults with awed eyes.
Right here,
Masterson said. Forrester studied the map. He'd never been there before, but it was easy to memorize the location.
Yes, I'd say that's a good place.
Jellison's Ranch, Sharp said. It's there. He knows me. He'll take us in. We'll go there. If we get separated, we'll meet there.
He pointed on the map.
Ask for Senator Jellison's place. Now, those that aren't coming with us, immediately get down and help survivors. Al, can you get any of these other cars started?
Yes, sir.
Masterson looked relieved. So did the others. They'd been used to taking orders from Sharps for years, and it felt right to have him in command again. They wouldn't obey him like soldiers, but they needed to be told to do what they wanted to do anyway.
Dan, you'll come on the caravan with us, Sharps said. You wouldn't be much use down below.
No,
Forrester said.
What?
Sharps was certain he'd misunderstood. The thunder was continuous, and now there was the sound of rising wind.
Can't,
Forrester said.
Need insulin.
It was then that Sharps remembered that Dan Forrester was a diabetic.
We can come by your place.
No,
Forrester screamed.
I've got other things to do. I'd delay you.
You've got...
I'll be all right,
Forrester said. He turned to walk off into the rain.
The hell you will,
Sharps screamed at Dan's retreating back.
You can't even get your car started when the battery's dead.
Forrester didn't turn. Sharps watched his friend, knowing he'd never see him again. The others pressed around. They all wanted advice, orders, some sense of purpose, and they expected Charles Sharps to provide it.
We'll see you at the ranch,
Sharps called. Forrester turned slightly and waved.
Let's move out,
Sharps said.
Station wagon in the middle.
He looked at his tiny command.
Preston, you'll be with me in the lead car. Get that shotgun and keep it loaded.
They piled into their cars and started across the broken lot, moving carefully to avoid the huge cracks and holes. Forrester's car had survived. He'd parked it at the very top of the lot, well away from any others, well away from trees and the edge of the bluff, and he'd parked it sideways to the tilt of the hill. Sharps could just make out Forrester's lights following them down to the street.
He hoped Dan had changed his mind and was following them, but when they got to the highway, he saw that Dan Forrester had turned off toward Tuhunga. The fire road narrowed to a pair of ruts tilted at an extreme angle, with a sloping drop of 50 feet or more to their right. Eileen fought for control of the car, then brought it to a stop. "We walk from here." She made no move to get out. The rain wasn't quite so bad now, but it was colder, and there was still continuous lightning visible all around them. The smell of ozone was strong and sharp.
"Let's go, then," Tim said.
"What's the hurry?"
"I don't know, but let's do it."
Tim couldn't have explained. He wasn't sure he understood it himself. To Hamner, life was civilized and relatively simple. You stayed out of the parts of town where money and social position weren't important, and everywhere they were, you hired people to do things, or bought the tools to do them with. Intellectually, he knew that all this was ending as he sat. Emotionally, well, this couldn't be Ragnarok. Ragnarok was supposed to kill you. The world was still here, and Tim wanted help. He wanted courteous police, briskly polite shopkeepers, civil servants. In short, civilization.
A towering wall of water sweeps eastward through the South Atlantic Ocean. Its left-hand edge passes the Cape of Good Hope, scouring lands which have been owned in turn by Hottentots, Dutch, British, and Afrikaners, sweeping up to curl at the base of Table Mountain, foaming up the wide valley to Paarl and Stellenbosch. The right-hand edge of the wave impacts against Antarctica, breaking off glaciers 10 miles long and 5 wide. The wave bursts through between Africa and Antarctica. When it reaches the wider expanse of the Indian Ocean, the wave has lost half its force. Now it is only 400 feet high. At 450 miles an hour, it moves toward India, Australia, and the Indonesian islands. It sweeps across the lowlands of southern India, then, focused by the narrowing Bay of Bengal, regains much of its strength and height as it breaks into the swamplands of Bangladesh. It smashes northward through Calcutta and Dhaka. The waters finally come to a halt at the base of the Himalayas, where they are met by the floods pouring out of the Ganges Valley. As the waters recede, the sacred Ganges is choked with bodies. They trudged through the mud, climbing steadily. The fire road went over the top of the hill in a saddle, not far below the peaks, but far enough. The lightning stayed above them. Their shoes picked up huge gobs of mud, and soon weighed 3 or 4 times what they should. They fell in the mud and got up again, helped each other when they could, and staggered up over the top and down the other side. The world condensed into a series of steps, one step at a time, no place to stop. Tim imagined the town ahead, undamaged, with motels and hot water and electric lights and a bar that sold Chivas Regal and Michelob. They reached blacktop pavement, and the going was easier.
"What time is it?" Eileen asked.
Tim pressed the button on his digital watch.
"Just about noon."
"It's so dark."
She slipped on wet leaves and tumbled onto the blacktop. She didn't get up.
"Eileen," Tim went over to help her. She was sitting on the pavement, and she didn't seem hurt, but she wasn't trying to get up. She was crying, quietly.
"You've got to get up."
"Why?"
"Because I can't carry you very far."
Almost she laughed, but then her face sank into her hands, and she sat huddled in the rain.
"Come on," said Tim. "It's not that bad. Maybe everything's all right up here. The National Guard will be out. Red Cross. Emergency tents."
He felt it evaporating as he named it. The stuff of dreams. But he went on, desperately.
"And we'll buy a car. There are car lots ahead. We'll buy a 4-wheel drive and take it to the observatory, with a big bucket from Colonel Chicken sitting between us. You buying all this?"
She shook her head and laughed in a funny way, and didn't get up. He bent and took her shoulders. She didn't resist, but she didn't help. Tim lifted her, got his arms under her legs, and began staggering down the blacktop road.
This is silly, Eileen said.
Damn betcha.
I can walk.
Good. He let her legs drop. She stood, but she clung to him, her head against his shoulder. Finally, she let go.
I'm glad I found you. Let's get moving.
Count off, Gordy called.
One, Andy Randall answered. The others sang out in turn. Two, three, four, five, Bert Vance said. He was a little late and glanced up nervously, but his father didn't seem to have noticed.
Six. And me, Gordy said. Okay, Andy, lead off. I'll play tail end Charlie.
They started down the trail. The cliff was less than a mile away. 20 minutes, no more. They rounded a bend and had a magnificent view stretching eastward across the tops of the pine trees. The morning air was crystal clear. The light was... funny. Gordy glanced at his watch. They'd been hiking 10 minutes. He was tempted to skip his compulsory halt for bootlace adjustments. What difference would it make? Nobody would have blisters, not in another half mile. And walking along, trying to be natural, was harder than the decision had been. There was a bright flash to the east, brilliant but small. Much too bright to be lightning, and out of a clear sky. It left an afterimage that blinking couldn't get rid of.
What was that, Dad? Bert asked.
Don't know. Meteor? Hold up, up in front. Time for boot adjustments.
They dropped their packs and found rocks to sit on. The bright afterimage was still there, although it was fading. Gordy couldn't look directly at his bootlaces. Then he noticed that the wind had died. The forest was deathly still. Bright flash, sudden stillness, like... The shockwave rumbled across them with a thunder of sound. A dead tree crashed somewhere above them, thrashing its final agony among its brothers. The rumbling went on a long time, with rising wind. Atom bomb at Frenchman's Flats, Gordy wondered. Couldn't be. They'd never test anything that big. So what was it? The boys were chattering. Then the ground rumbled and heaved beneath them. More trees fell. Gordy fell onto his pack. The other boys had been shaken off their rocks. One, Herbie Robinette, seemed to be hurt. Gordy crawled toward him. The boy wasn't bleeding, and nothing was broken, just shaken up.
"Stay down!" Gordy shouted, "and watch for falling limbs and trees!"
The wind continued to rise, but it was shifting, moving around to the south, no longer coming from the east, where they'd seen the bright flash. The earth shook again. And out there, far beyond the horizon, rising high into the stratosphere, was an ugly cloud, mushroom-shaped. It climbed on and on, roiling horribly. It was just where the bright flash had been. One of the boys had a radio. He had it to his ear.
"Nothing but static, Mr. Vance. I keep thinking I hear something else, but I can't make out what."
"Not surprising. We almost never get anything in the mountains in daytime," Gordy said.
"I don't like that wind."
"And what was that thing?
A piece of the comet?"
"Probably."
Gordy laughed bitterly. All that fuss about the end of the world, and it was nothing. A bright flash out there in Death Valley. Or maybe it wasn't the comet at all. Frenchman's Flat was that way. 150 miles or so. The ground had stopped shaking.
"Let's move on," Gordy said.
"On your feet."
He pulled on his pack. "Now what?" he asked himself. "Can I... will the boys be all right without me? What's happening out there?" "Nothing. Nothing but a goddamn meteor. Maybe a big one. Maybe as big as that thing in Arizona, the one that made a half-mile crater. An impressive thing, and the boys saw it fall. They'll talk about it for years. But it doesn't solve my problem. The bank examiners will still be around next Friday, and..."
"Funny clouds up there," Andy Randall said. There was worry in his voice.
"Yeah, sure," Gordy said absently. Then he noticed where Andy was pointing.
Southwest, almost due south. It was as if a pool of black ink had been poured across the sky. Huge, towering black clouds rising higher and higher, blotting out everything.
and the wind was howling through the trees. More clouds and more, seeming to form from nothing, and racing toward them at terrific velocity, faster than jet planes. Gordy looked frantically along the trail. No good place to hide. "Ponchos!" he shouted. They scrabbled their rain gear out. As Gordy flipped his poncho open, the rain came like a torrent of warm bathwater. Gordy tasted salt. "Salt. Hammerfall," he whispered. And the end of civilization. The paper shortages at the bank, gone, washed away. They weren't important now. "Marie." The clouds were building above Los Angeles, and it was a long way to the nearest car. Nothing he could do for her. No way to help Marie. Maybe Harvey Randall would look out for her. Right now, Gordy's problem was the boys. "Back to Soda Springs," he shouted. It was the best place until they found out just what was going to happen. It was sheltered, and there was a clearing and a flat. "I want to go home," Herbie Robinette screamed. "Get 'em moving, Andy," Gordy called. He waved them ahead of him, ready to shove them if he had to, but he didn't. They followed Andy. Bert went past. Gordy thought he saw tears in his son's eyes, tears through the dirty rainwater that hammered at them. "The trails will all be flooded in no time, washed out," Gordy thought, "and this warm crap will melt all the snow. The Kern's going to be up over its banks, and all the roads will be gone." Gordy Vance suddenly threw back his head and yelled in triumph. He was going to live. Hot Fudge Tuesday, 3. When Adam farmed and Eve span, Kyrie eleison. Who was then the gentleman? Kyrie eleison. Marching song of the Black Company during the Peasant Revolt, Germany, 1525. Harvey Randall had been 15 minutes from home, until Hammerfall. It was day turned night, and the night was alive with pyrotechnics. If daylight still leaked through the black cloud cover, the lightning was far brighter. Hills flashed in blue-white light and vanished, now a white sky over jagged black skyline, now a look into the canyon on his left, now blackness lit only by the headlamps of cars, now a nearby blast that clenched Randall's eyelids in pain. The wipers were going like crazy, but the rain fell faster. It all came through in a blur. Randall had rolled down both side windows. Wet was better than blind. To drive in such conditions was madness, yet the traffic was still heavy. Perhaps they were all mad. Through the thunder and the drum of rain on metal came the bleat of myriad horns. Cars shifted lanes without warning. They drove in the oncoming lanes and butted their way back into line when oncoming lights faced them down. Randall's travel-all was too big to challenge. Where a landslide had blocked half the road and a coward had stopped to let oncoming traffic through, Randall drove the travel-all over the slide. It tilted badly, but held, and in front of the coward and straight at the traffic, and butted the lead car until it backed up. He didn't see the people who blocked his way. He saw only barriers, mudslides, breaks in the road, cars. He kept wondering if the house had collapsed with Loretta inside, or if Loretta, in blind panic, was about to come looking for him in the car. She'd never survive alone, and they'd never link up. Hell, it was almost an hour since Hammerfall. The looters would come sooner or later. Loretta knew where to find his gun, but would she use it? Randall turned onto Fox Lane in floodwater that was hubcap deep, drove to the end, used the remote. All the houses were dark. The garage door didn't open. But the front door was wide open. The looting couldn't have started this soon, Randall thought, and he made himself believe it. Just for drill, then, he took the flashlight and handgun with him, and he left the travel-all in a roll and immediately rolled back under the car and studied the situation from there. The house looked dead, and rain was blowing in the door. He rolled out and sprinted and pulled up alongside the door. He still hadn't used the flash. First person he saw, he'd flicked the beam in her face. It would be Loretta coming to close the door, and if she had his gun, he was going to do a swan dive off the steps, because the way he was behaving, she'd be scared enough to shoot. He poked head and flash around the door jamb. Lightning only made confusing shadows. Thunder drowned out other sounds. He flicked on the flashlight. It jumped at him. It hit him straight in the face. Loretta was lying on the floor, face up. Her face and chest were a shapeless, wet ruin, the kind left by a shotgun blast. Kipling, headless, was a mess of blood and fur beside her. He walked inside and couldn't feel his legs. Walking on pillows, they call it, the last stage of exhaustion before collapse. He knelt, set the gun down. It never occurred to him that someone might be here, and reached for Loretta's throat. He drew his hand back with a rippling shudder and reached for her wrist instead. There was no pulse. Thank God. What would he have done? They hadn't raped her, as if that mattered now, but they hadn't taken the jewelry off her wrists either, and though the drawers from the buffet had been pulled out and dumped, the good silver was still lying there. Why? What could they have wanted? Randall's thoughts were slow and confused. They took strange paths. A part of him believed none of this, not the body of his wife, flickering in lightning, in and out of existence, not the weird weather, nor the earthquakes, nor the translation of a great light show into the end of the world. When he got up and went into the bedroom for something to cover Loretta, it was because he had been staring at her until he couldn't stand it anymore. The dresser drawers were all pulled out. Randall saw cufflinks and a gold ring and Loretta's amethyst brooch and matching earrings in the wreckage. The closets had been rifled, too. Where were... Yes, they'd taken both of his overcoats. He waded through the wreckage. The bed was piled high with senseless things, pantyhose, bottles of cosmetics, lipsticks. He swept it to the floor, pulled the bedclothes off the bed, and dragged them behind him into the hall. Something echoed in his mind, but he shied from it. He covered Loretta. He sat down again. At no time had he wondered if they were still here, but he tried to picture the people who had done this. He, she, all men, all women, a mixed group. What could they have wanted? They'd left silver and jewelry, but taken overcoats. Randall shambled into the kitchen. They'd found and taken the beef jerky and his stock of vitamins and all of his canned soup. Now he saw it, and he kept looking. They'd taken his canned gasoline from the garage. They'd taken his guns. They'd been ready. They'd planned this. At the moment of hammerfall, they had already known what they would do. Had they picked his house at random, or his street, they could have raided every house on the block. He was back in the entrance hall with Loretta. "You wanted me to stay," he told her. More words clogged in his throat. He shook his head and went into the bedroom. He was tired to death. He stood beside the bed, staring at what had been on the bed. This was what didn't make sense. Pantyhose still in the packages. Shampoo, hair conditioner, skin conditioner, nail polish, a couple of dozen large bottles, lipsticks, eyebrow pencils, chapsticks, emery boards, new boxes of curlers, scores of items. If he could figure this out, maybe he'd know who. He could go after them. He still had the handgun. Even in his stupor, he didn't really believe it. They were gone, and he was here with Loretta. He sat down on the bed and stared at Loretta's hairbrush and dark glasses. Oh, of course. The hammer had fallen, and Loretta had started packing her survival kit, the things she couldn't live without. Then the killers had come and killed her, and left behind as garbage the lipsticks and eyebrow pencils and pantyhose Loretta couldn't face life without. But they'd taken the suitcase. Harvey rolled over on his belly and hid his face in his arms. Thunder and rain roared in his ears, drowning thoughts he wanted drowned. He was aware that there was someone looking at him. The thunder went on and on. He couldn't have heard a noise. But there were eyes on him, and he remembered not to move, and then he remembered why. When he moved, it would have to be suddenly, and... He'd left the gun sitting beside Loretta. Oh, the hell with it. He rolled over.
Harv?
He didn't answer.
Harv, it's Mark. My God, man, what happened?
Don't know. Raiders. He had almost dozed off when Mark spoke again.
You all right, Harv?
I wasn't here. I was interviewing a goddamn professor at UCLA, and I was in a traffic jam, and I wasn't here. Leave me alone. Mark shifted from one foot to the other. He wandered around the bedroom, looking into closets.
Harv, we've got to get out of here. You and your damn hot fudge sundae. The whole L.A. basin is under the ocean, you know that?
She wanted me to stay. She was scared, said Harvey. He tried to think of some way to make Mark go away.
Get out and leave me alone. Can't, Harv. We have to bury your old lady. Got a shovel?
Oh, Harvey opened his eyes. The room was still lit by surrealistic strobe lighting. Funny, he didn't notice the thunder anymore. He got up.
There's one out in the garage, I think. Thanks.
They dug in the backyard. Harvey wanted to do it all, but he ran out of energy quickly, and Mark took over. The shovel made squishing sounds. The hard adobe was soaking faster than Mark could dig. Squish, plop, squish, plop, and rolling thunder.
Time!
Mark called. He was standing in a waist-deep hole, his boots nearly underwater.
Noon!
Harvey looked around, startled at the voice from behind him. Joanna was perched above them on the slope, rain running down her face. She held a shotgun, and she looked very alert.
Deep enough, Mark said. Stay here, Harv. Joe, let's go inside. Give Harv the shotgun.
Right.
She came down from the slope, a tiny figure with a big shotgun. She handed it to Harvey without a word. He stood in the rain, standing guard by looking down into an empty grave. If someone had come up behind him, he wouldn't have noticed, or cared, except that he did notice Mark and Joanna. Big Mark and tiny Joanna carrying a blanketed bundle. Harvey went over to help her carry, but he was too late. They lowered her into the grave. Water flowed up and around the blanket. It was an electric blanket, Harvey saw. Loretta's electric blanket. She could never stay warm enough at night. Mark took the shovel, Joanna took the shotgun. Mark shoveled steadily. Squish, plop. Harvey tried to think of something to say, but there weren't any words. Finally,
thanks. Yeah, you want to read any words?
I ought to, Harvey said. He started toward the house, but he couldn't go in.
Here, this was in the bedroom,
Joanna said. She took a small book out of her pocket. It was Andy's confirmation prayer book. Loretta must have included that in her survival kit. She would have. Harvey opened it to the prayers for the dead. Rain soaked the page before he could read it, but he found a line, half read and half remembered.
Eternal rest grant her, O Lord, and let light perpetual shine upon her.
He couldn't see any more. After a long time, Mark and Joanna led Harvey into the house. They sat at the kitchen table.
We don't have long, Mark said. I think we saw your raiders.
They killed Frank Stoner,
Joanna added.
Who? Harvey demanded. What did they look like? Can we track the bastards? Tell you later, Mark said. First we get packed up and moving.
You'll tell me now.
No.
Joanna had rested the shotgun against the table. Harvey picked it up calmly and checked the loads. He pulled one outside hammer back. His firearms training was excellent. He didn't point it at anyone.
I want to know, Harvey Randall said.
They were bikers, Joanna said quickly. Half a dozen of them riding escort with a big blue van. We saw them turn out of Fox Lane.
Those bastards, Harvey said. I know where they live. Short side street, half a mile from here. The street's half a block long. They repainted the sign to read Snow Mountain.
He stood.
They won't be there now, Mark said. They went north, toward Mulholland.
Frank and Mark and I, Joanna said, we had our bikes.
"They were coming out of your street," Mark said. "I wanted to know what was happening in there. I stopped and held up my hand, you know, the way bikers stop each other for a friendly talk, and one of the sons of bitches blasted at me with a shotgun."
"And they missed Mark and hit Frank," Joanna said. "Frank went right over the edge. If the shotgun didn't kill him, the fall did. The bikers kept on going. We didn't know what to do, so we came here as fast as we could."
"Jesus," Harvey said. "I got here half an hour before you. They were here, somewhere, right near here, while I was... while..."
"Yeah," Joanna said. "We'll know them if we see them again. Big bikes. Chopped, but not much. And murals on the van. We'll know them."
"Never saw that gang before," Mark added. "No way we can catch up with them just now. Harv, we can't stay here. The L.A. basin's flooded. Everybody down there is dead from the tsunami. But there must be a million people in the hills around here, and there sure ain't enough for a million people to eat. There's got to be a better place to go."
"Frank wanted to head for the Mojave," Joanna said. "But Mark thought we ought to look in on you."
Harvey said nothing. He put the shotgun down and stared at the wall. They were right. He couldn't catch the bike crew. Not now. And he was very tired.
"They leave anything at all?" Mark demanded.
Harvey didn't answer.
"We'll do a search anyway," Mark said. "Joe, you take the house. I'll go the rounds outside, garage, everything. Only we can't leave the travel all by itself. Come on, Harv."
He took Harvey's arm and pulled him to his feet. Mark was surprisingly strong. Harvey made no resistance. Mark led him to the travel all and put him in the passenger seat. He put the Olympic target pistol in Harvey's lap. Then he locked all the doors, leaving Harvey sitting inside, still staring at the rain.
"He going to be all right?" Joanna asked.
"Don't know, but he's ours," Mark said. "Come on, let's see what we can find."
Mark found Harvey's Clorox bottles of water in the garage. There were other things. Sleeping bags, wet but serviceable. Evidently the bikers had their own and didn't bother. Stupid, Mark thought. Harv's Army Arctic was better than any the bikers would have. After a while, he brought his salvage to the travel-all and opened the back. Then he got the small dirt bikes he and Joanna had ridden and brought them around. He started to ask Harvey to help, but instead found a heavy 2x8 and used it as a ramp. With Joanna's help, he wrestled one of the bikes into the back and piled stuff in on top of it.
"Harv, where's Andy?"
Mark said finally.
"Safe, up in the mountains, with Gordy Vance."
"Marie!"
Harvey shouted. He jumped out of the car and ran toward Gordy's house. Then he stopped. The front door was open. Harvey stood there, afraid to go in. What if they'd been in Gordy's place while Harvey was mooning over Loretta? Jesus, what a goddamn useless bastard I am. Mark went into the Vance house. He came out a few minutes later.
"Looted, but nobody home. No blood, nothing."
He went to the garage and tried to open the door. It came open easily. The lock was broken. When it swung up, the garage was empty.
"Harv, what kind of car did your buddy have?"
"Caddy," Harvey said.
"Then she left, 'cause there's no car here and no caddy with the bikers. You get back and watch the travel all. There's more of your stuff we'll need, or come help carry."
"In a minute." Harvey went back to the car and stood thinking. Where would Marie Vance go? She was his responsibility. Gordy was taking care of Harvey's boy. Gordy's wife would be Harvey's lookout. Only Harvey didn't have a clue as to where Marie might be. Yes, he did. Los Angeles Country Club. Governor's fundraising thingy. Crippled children. Marie was on the board. She'd have been there for Hammerfall. And if she hadn't got back here by now, she wasn't coming back. Marie wasn't Harvey's responsibility anymore. Mark came out of the house, and Harvey was finally startled. Mark was carrying something. Oh, my God. Carrying $5,000 worth of Steuben Crystal Whale, Loretta's wedding present from her family. A couple of years ago, Loretta had thrown Mark out of the house for picking it up.
Mark got the whale to the van without dropping it. He wrapped it in sheets and pillowcases and spare blankets.
"What's all that for?"
Harvey asked. He pointed to the whale and the skin cream and Kleenex and the remains of Loretta's survival kit and other things.
"Trade goods," Mark said. "Your paintings, some luxury items. If we find something better, we dump the lot, but we might as well be carrying something. Jesus, Harv, I'm glad your head's working again. We're about to load up. Want to get in, or do you want to take another look through the house?"
"I can't go back in there."
"Right, okay."
He raised his voice.
"Joe, let's move it."
"Right."
She appeared from out of a hedge, soaking wet, still holding the shotgun.
"You up to driving, Harv?"
Mark demanded.
"It's a big car for Joanna to handle."
"I can drive."
"Fine. I'll be outrider with the bike. Give me the pistol, and Joe keeps the shotgun. One thing, Harv. Where are we going?"
"I don't know," Harvey said. "North. I'll think of something once we get started."
"Right."
The motorcycle could hardly be heard over the roar of the thunder. They drove out, north toward Mulholland, along the same route the bikers had taken, and Harvey kept hoping. It rained. Dan Forrester saw his path in split-second flashes when the frenetic wipers disturbed the flood of water across his windshield. The rain ate the light of his headlamps before the light could reach the road. Continuous lightning gave more light, but the rain scattered it into flashing white murk. Rivers ran across the twisting mountain road. The car plowed through them. In the valleys it must be... Well, he would learn soon enough. There were preparations he must make first. Charlie Sharps would know sooner. Dan worried for Charlie. Charlie's chances weren't poor, but he should not have been traveling with that loaded station wagon. It was too obviously worth stealing. But Masterson might have packed guns, too. Even if they reached the ranch, would Senator Jellison let them in? Ranch country, high above the floods. If they accepted everyone who came, their food would be gone in a day, their livestock the next. They might let Charlie Sharps in alone. They probably would not require the services of Dan Forrester, Ph.D., ex-astrophysicist. Who would? Dan was surprised to find that he'd driven home. He zapped the garage door, and it opened. Huh. He still had electricity. That wouldn't last. He left the door open. Inside, he turned on some lights, then set out a great many candles. He lit two. The house was small. There was one big room, and the walls of that room were bookshelves, floor to ceiling. Dan's dining table was piled high with his equipment. He had bought his fair share of freeze-dried foods while they existed, but Dan had thought further than that. He had carried home far more than his share of Ziploc bags and salad-sized baggies, insect spray and mothballs. The table was full. He set to work on the floor. He whistled as he worked. Spray a book with insect spray, drop it in a bag, add some mothballs and seal it. Put it in another bag and seal it. Another. The packages piled up on the floor, each a book sealed in four plastic envelopes. Presently he got up to put on some gloves. He came back with a fan and set it blowing past his ears from behind. That ought to keep the insecticide off his hands and out of his lungs. When the pile on the floor got too big, he moved, and when the second pile was as high as the first, he stood up carefully. His joints were stiff. His feet hurt. He moved his legs to build circulation. He started coffee in the kitchen. The radio gave him nothing but static, so he started a stack of records going. There was now room at the kitchen table. He resumed work there. The two piles merged into one. The lights went out. The Beatles' voices deepened and slowed and stopped. Dan was suddenly immersed in darkness and sounds he'd been ignoring. Rolling thunder, the scream of wind and the roar of rain attacking the house. Water had begun to drip from a corner of the ceiling. He got coffee in the kitchen, then moved around the library lighting candles. Hours had passed. The forgotten coffee had already been heated too long. Four-fifths of the shelves were still full, but most of the right books were in bags.
Dan walked along the bookshelves. Weariness reinforced his deep melancholy. He had lived in this house for 12 years, but it was twice that long since he'd read Alice in Wonderland, and The Water Babies, and Gulliver's Travels. These books would rot in an abandoned house. Dune, Nova, Double Star, The Corridors of Time, Cat's Cradle, Half Past Human, Murder in Retrospect, Gideon's Day, The Red Right Hand, The Trojan Hearse, A Deadly Shade of Gold, Conjure Wife, Rosemary's Baby.